So, thanks a lot. We've heard a lot about mechanical properties, forces, materials, and things like that. And so, just to let you sort of still arrive properly and digest your food, I wanted to sort of show you something which sort of, as an experimentalist, sort of anchors me from time to time when I hear about creepy solids and things like that. I wanted to show you a creepy solid, live and on stage. So I have it in a movie for the people in the back who won't be able to see, but I also have it here. So this is just something that I can mold and do stuff with, and I can mold it into a ball, and then if I let the ball bounce, it bounces off. So it's on short times reasonably solid or elastic, and on long times it's reasonably plastic and deforms. But it's not just silly putty, it's not just stupid. It's actually active. So if I put this here onto a magnet, you'll see it eat up the magnet, which actually is what the movie shows. So I'll just show you this as well. Had it running before.
Look, this is very, very slow timescales.
This is right. Let me do something else. I'll just do that again. Left the mouse as a mouse because then it'll work. Right, so that's how it'll do, that's how it'll go. That's how this just went, right? And for the people here, I can take it off and do it from the other side. So I have my ball of stuff here. It'll just eat it up. Right, so what this is a silly putty, but that has lots of ferromagnetic particles in it, so it's actually magnetic. And this thing here is a really, really strong magnet, which is why I will not pass it around in view of all the laptops and iPads and so forth sitting around here. Because it's really sort of, you have to be careful with it. So that's sort of where we'll go in the end, at least to a certain stage. And that brings me to my outline, which is not really according to what the time will be. So this is about the first half, and this is about the second half. So, at least according to my planning, which will probably be messed up. So, I'll first want to show you a little bit about stuff that we did a few years ago, which sort of tells you why you actually might want to measure forces and why that might be interesting. So, we'll sort of look at mechanical feedback growth models and what we then did to direct mechanical perturbations of this and what we found out about mechanical properties, which are, of course, needed to sort of do this properly. And then we'll see some other things that sort of say that forces are not distributed homogeneously. So you actually have to do more than just overall mechanical properties, like viscoelastic descriptions or anything like that. So you'll have to actually look locally. And this is sort of then the second half, the story of us trying to measure locally what forces are active in a tissue. So, with all that being said, I'd sort of, the audience has changed a bit from previous weeks, so I'm not completely sure we're all on the same page, but so what we're doing is we're looking at the wing imaginal disc of Drosophila, which hopefully all of you know what it is. If not, then please shout now. So, with that being said, there's lots of work that has been done on this, and then harks back to Boris's work, and then something that we did as well, again, 10-ish years ago, about how to model the growth of the wing disc when taking into account growth factors, but also mechanical forces. And so the overall gist of it is sort of what Ken has done a week or two ago very nicely, sort of looking at how this idea goes, is that you have something in the center which grows more rapidly. That gives you tension along the boundary, compression in the center, and then if tension increases, growth, and compression decreases it, you get some homogeneous growth, which is sort of the conundrum that you had in the wing disc. We have then sort of later stages gone on and made this a bit more detailed and have looked at many more of the regulatory mechanisms that have been sort of looked at by various labs over very many years. So this whole thing here is decades of works of many, many labs, which we have then sort of put together and taken in and looked at what does what. The thing that we've added is this orange bit, which says that mechanical compression inhibits Yorkie, which is then basically the mechanical feedback for the growth regulation that we have done. And this sort of harks back again to Ken's talk, who has actually looked at how Yorkie is influenced by tensions and mechanical forces. And this one little arrow is actually much more complicated than that. Right? But I'm a physicist, I just draw this little arrow. So, and if you haven't seen it, then you just have to watch Ken's talk online, which you actually can. Right. So this is the biochemical bit of this network, which then, of course, also has to take into account the greater distributions of these growth factors and so forth. And then there's the mechanical bit, which we treat cells as polygons, where we look at the vertices and move these according to some energy function, which has actually been first done by Frank Jülich's group. And in all of these cells, we have something behind that, because this is basically just supposed to be the apical surface. We have something behind that which has the volume, which is the growth, which sort of harks back to the biochemical network. And then when that volume reaches a certain threshold, it divides, which will give you division here, and then that relaxes mechanically. So one thing that I always like to show in that context is how a cell actually looks like in this wing disc. Now that's it, to scale. So this is the thing that we're modeling, this little tiny bit up here. Because this is the apical side, this is where the junction molecules are and all that sort of things. If you look 3D down below, it's a complete mess. Right? First of all, it's very elongated, but then if you look at a textbook of a sort of nice columnar epithelium, you actually see columns. That's why they're called columnar. But those are the columns that these things are made out of. So if you actually measure the volume of one of these cells and plot it as a function of the apical area, you don't find any relation whatsoever. Which, as a physicist, you think is strange and crazy, but it's just the way it is. So that's why we can treat the apical areas in the model separate from the volumes. Right, so then we do that. We run this and we find basically what has been found before. We find that there's a compression gradient that's built up. So this is the simulation. The compression is just measured in apical areas. Blue is small, yellow, red is big. And so as it grows, it becomes more and more compressed in the center, and there's more and more stretching in the surroundings. What you also see is that that compression gradient, as it grows, actually on absolute scales becomes shallower as it grows on. And so eventually, this shallow gradient will again stop the growth, and that's sort of what leads to growth control. And then we've measured this in wing discs and wing pouches for very young ones, middle ones, and older ones, where we basically see the same sort of qualitative behavior. You can, of course, also look at mechanical stretching, tensions, compressions, not just from the apical areas, but from the elongations of the cells. So if you look at the elongation of the cell, what you'll find is that in the periphery, so around here, they are more tangentially elongated. What that means is, so you have your cell, which is elongated, say, that way, then this has a long axis here. Now, if you have a disk, then you can describe, define the center of that disk, and then a radial distance, and so then that would be the tangential distance. And so the angle to that radial distance is plotted here as a color code. And so red is 90 degrees to the radial distance, so red would be lying like this, and blue would be lying like this. And so if you look in the periphery, you'll find a lot more red cells than any other color. If you look at the center, you'll find about the same numbers of red and blue, which you can quantify. You can quantify in the model and in the data, and yes.
There's also this.
There's also this cross of AP and DV.
Yeah.
I will completely ignore it. But yes, there is that, and there are tensions in there, and yes, but I'll completely ignore it.
Okay.
And so you can do that. Yes.
So aside from orientation, so the extent of an axonotropy is also important, right?
Yes.
And I guess the question is, so looking at your AP and DV boundaries.
Yes.
In which cells are more less anisotropic.
Yes. So. This is just the angles. But yes, we can actually.
You don't have some plot where you just lay out the magnitude of an
isotope. Magnitude of the elongation. No, I don't. I was just looking for that, but I don't. But it sort of is more. The absolute value is more elongated in the radial, in the peripheral than in the central. Yes.
But when you divide the cell in your simulation, you take into account cell shape. I mean, there is a preferred axis of division.
There, in the experiment, one finds that there is, but we don't do that, and we still get away with it.
Nope.
So.
Okay.
So, if we divide the cell, we basically do a random orientation. At least that's what I have in mind. But you have to ask Tinri if you want to know the details. She knows it much better than I do.
Do you have a graph showing the distribution of volumes?
No, I don't. And that's basically because of this. To determine the volumes in these things halfway accurately is basically near to impossible. Because if you want to stain the volume of this, you will make so many mistakes in assessing which cell is which and which is a neighbor of which that what you'll get out will be complete nonsense. So no, we don't.
What is the dynamics in your model?
The dynamics?
Yes.
So we have two types of dynamics, actually. So one is basically this biochemical thing,
yeah,
which sort of has timescales of what induces what on what timescales. And then we have the other timescale, which is actually the relaxation of the mechanical property or the mechanical distribution of properties. And that is thought to be quick in relation to the others. So we'll do this separately, and then we have a biochemical thing that lets us grow. Then we divide. When we divide, we change this, and when this is changed, then we relax this mechanically, and then we let the other thing go on.
So you see a separation of time scales?
Yes.
Okay.
Right. And so then there's other people who have done and found pretty much the same things. So you can do this not just by areas and selling elongations, but you can also do it by laser cuts, or you can do it by refringence. So laser cuts have been done by Loic Le Goff and Yan Lan Mao in two separate sets of experiments. And these are Yan Lan Mao's data. So basically, they separate the disk into a central bit and a peripheral bit. And then in this central bit and in the peripheral bit, they look at cell junctions and then look at whether these are sort of in the, let's see, proximal distal would mean that way, and lateral would mean that way, relative to where the center is. And then they cut something like this, or cut something like this, look at how it retracts, and that then is their characterization of under what tension that cell is. And then if you have something which is distal at the center, or if you look at the center both ways, they're basically the same. And if you look at in the periphery, then these ones here, or these ones there, are under higher tension than the others, which is basically because they're stretched. They release more that way. And then you can also do this as a function of age of the disk, and again, that sort of fits with what one would expect. So if you look at this, that sort of agrees with this cartoon thing of you have something which starts growing, then stretches the stuff around it, which means that something is compressed in the middle. So that prediction of that model or of that class of models seems to be not too far from what is actually happening. So what you still have to go is to actually see that this has something to do with growth or proliferation, which again, if you look at Ken's Hippo pathway data, that sort of already points in that direction. So we have gone in the not genetic molecular direction of doing that. And there's two ways that we sort of look at this. And one is, we'll just look at how a wing disc actually grows within a larva. So these things grow in three larval stages, and in these larval stages, basically the fly does nothing but eat, and the tissue does nothing but divide and grow. And so this is Ulrike Nienhaus's work. What she does is she fixes such a larva between two cover slips and then arranges it carefully such that the wing disc lies right at the edge here. And then the water, or the PBS, and the glass slide basically make that the cuticle is more or less index matched, and so with a confocal she can basically image through and image the wing disc as a function of time, not with great time resolution and not for a very long time, because right, this thing is immobilized, doesn't do anything, so it's very unhappy. So basically you image this for a few seconds and then release it, and then a couple of hours later you take the same guy and image it again. But then you can do it for the whole development. And then this happily becomes a fly and flies off. Well, it doesn't, because it's genetically modified, so it has to be so forth, right? So it doesn't fly off.
Sorry, just a small technical question. Like, this thing doesn't wiggle too much in between those two plates.
Nope. So, I mean, basically what's happening is that you take out the right amount of PBS, that capillary forces just press this together so it doesn't actually have any way to wiggle. And so it just stays in place. Right, and so this is what you then find. This is a first instar wing disk where it actually has these whatever 20 cells at the beginning, and then this is sort of mid-third instar. And the scale bar here is 50 microns for all of these images. No, it's 20 microns for all of these images. 20 microns. Right, so we can then look at cell shapes, cell sizes, as a function of time. We can also look at what happens at different times. And so what you see, not very clearly in any of these things, but at one point in sort of mid to late second instar phase, this wing disk is still pretty small. It hasn't actually grown much. But what you can see is that it actually looks like there's something pulling on this here, just from how these cell shapes are changed and elongated. You can then take this wing disk, dissect it, and put it under a microscope. When you've done that, it looks like this. That's the exact same thing. So you see this little bit here is actually this bit here. So this is actually a muscle fiber which connects this to the leg discs and which actually contracts in around that time. And so this is sort of a maybe epsilon of one order strain that is put on these things just in normal life that they have. So this is sort of, we'll put in perspective what we'll actually do to the wing discs later on. Another thing that you see is that when this thing is so stretched out and you look 4 hours later, it may have relaxed a bit, but if you then go and count the cells here and count the cells here, there's many more here than there were there. So this sort of tells you that there's probably some connection to proliferation and tension. You can also do this sort of over all the ranges of growth and then just sort of use average apical area for stress or mechanical constraint and look at the growth rate that you see in the tissue. And you see that that sort of, it's not a very nice line, but it sort of has a clear trend. And this is, again, all just in vivo from mid-second instar to late third instar.
Growth rate means number of cells.
Growth rate means number of cells added per hour, per number of cells that were there. Yeah.
So we should be thinking of this as a collapse of rate of growth versus apical area. So presumably that individual disk already has some gradient in cell size from whatever proximal to distal, and of course as a function of time from whatever first, second, third, the whole thing is changing. And when you image, you look at these disks from various times, and then you combine, and presumably you look at cells in different parts of the disk, and it all falls on the same curve.
Yeah.
And so how many points so are we looking at in this, roughly, how many disks?
So, I mean, these are, times are, what, roughly, so once every 4 hours for the 60-ish hours of development, mid-second to late third. Mm-hmm. So that's about 12 points. Per individual, and we have about 15 of those. And in each of these things, you've seen the number of cells that you have that we sort of then average for the average cell area and things like that. Right, so that's a couple of hundred.
So presumably, so we go back to this question of collapse. So you have so much data that in principle
you can split it into two halves, early disks and late disks, and then...
You will actually find that there's very...
walk into colors and hopefully see that the two things are still on top of each other.
Yeah. But you will find that most of the late disks are here, and most of the early disks, or mid-second to early third, are here. Right, so that sort of gives you an indication of that there's something going on there. And so then we went and sort of did directly measuring what happens. And that's Thomas Schluck's work. So what he does is he takes a wing disk and dissects it out of the larva without touching it, which is a skill you have to learn. And then attaches it on one end here on a cover slide, and then slides another cover slide underneath it, and then lets it drop down, and then it's attached to that cover slide. And the attachment is done by polylysine. And then this cover slide here is attached to an arm, and that arm is movable and has a known bending stiffness. And so we can then sort of know what force we apply to this thing when we pull out. And so then what he does is he takes one of these discs, has it in whatever good medium we had at the time, which is by far not as good as what Suzanne Eden has been telling us about. So we can only do this for about an hour or two. After that, these things are definitely not happy anymore. Probably they're already not very happy before. But what we can do is we can do nothing and look what happens. And we can stretch them and do what happens and then look at relative what happens as a change. And then what we still have to do is we have to look at what's the proliferation rate in the disks. And for this, what we do is, well, we image cells. And mitotic cells are very easy to recognize, right? So there's one here, there's one there, and there's one there. Because as cells divide, they round up, nucleus comes up, they divide, things go down. So over the time course of 20 minutes, what you see is that, right, that thing has just divided. That one is just about to finish, and then it's gone. So that was a movie that takes 20 minutes. So then we can do that, right? So we can look at a wing disk where it's attached, everything's the same. We just don't pull. And we see dividing cells here. And all we have to do is follow whatever divides as a function of time. And what you'll actually see is that there's not that many that will divide over that hour, right? Many of these are still here, which basically tells you that these things are not happy. But there's a couple that have divided. I'll play it again for you. So you see that one there, that has divided, and there was another one here and there. Yep. That's late 13 star. That's basically wandering stage. So we don't want to do this with smaller disks because that's just a nightmare. And then you do this and you pull on it. And so then what you'll see is you'll see dividing cells, you'll see them here, you'll see them come up, go down. And so you can count however many you've seen here being added as a function of that hour. And so then that gives you a proliferation rate that you can plot as a function of how much you've pulled. And you do this for a couple of disks, about 5 to 8, depending on how strongly we pulled. And then you find that this proliferation rate actually grows as you pull on it. Which sort of is what you would have predicted.
Can the deformation corresponding to these forces comparable to, let's say, change in area in the growth versus area plot?
It's not too far off, but it's a bit, I mean, it depends on where you look. And we'll get to that in a bit. But it depends on where you look, how much deformation you have, right? So if you look at the wing pouch here, so if you take this relative to that, that's maybe a 30 to 50% extension. Whereas if you look at the whole disc, that's about almost a factor of two, which is basically because what you're doing is you're pulling out the fold. So that depends a bit on how you determine the deformation, whether it will fit or not. All right, there's one thing, one more thing we can do. And
so
that's,
can I just,
yes.
Just check I understand the time scales right. So that increase in proliferation rate is within 60 minutes.
Within an hour, yes.
Stretches applied.
Yes. I mean, actually, the proliferation rate is calculated over 1 hour. Right. So it's the number of cells that have been added on in the time scale of that hour that we've actually pulled.
And that's starting at the as soon as possible after
right.
the dissection.
Right. Which takes 10 to 15 minutes, to be honest. Right. So that was a very, very global measure, right? So, I mean, what you said, Boris, about the deformations is, of course, relevant. And because here we're just sort of saying we apply an overall force on this whole thing and we look at an overall growth rate. And basically, mechanistically, you would, of course, think that that's on a cell level. And so that sort of is the promo slide for the second half of the talk, which is that it's not that simple to sort of go from this overall force that you apply and growth rate that you see to a cell-based thing. And so what are you seeing here? What you're seeing here is a patch of tissue of the wing disc where we've actually looked with cellular resolution. And we've looked before we pulled and then after we pulled. And then we've looked at the elongations of these and color-coded the change in elongation that we see. Red is very elongated this way, so that way. And blue is very elongated that way. And we've pulled this way, so that way. Now you see a lot of red, a lot of blue, and a lot of in between. And that's the point, right? The forces here are distributed very inhomogeneously. So the force that you apply here, it sort of goes in some force chain that way, mostly. But if you've ever tried to compress or stretch a piece of foam, you see that this is actually inhomogeneous. You get the same thing if you pour a bucket of sand on the floor. The main force is not directly underneath the tip, but somewhere sideways. So in cellular materials, this is actually an important thing that you have to take into account. And so it could be that some cells here are under more tension than you'd expect and some are under less. And so, yes?
I was just going to ask if this changes over time. So if you look a bit later, do you see the same cells being less or more elongated, or is it just an instability that
so here what we do is we just look before we stretch and then after we stretch and then we keep this constant and then there's no dynamics afterwards because these cells do not really rearrange or change their shapes afterwards. What I don't know, which is a thing that one probably should do, is if we then relax it and stretch it again, what happens? Right. And I don't know. But, I mean, what this tells you basically is that what you need in order to connect forces mechanistically to growth is you need a local force sensor. You need a local way to measure forces. Yes?
Yes, so... exactly connected into that thing. So what you're showing here is basically local strains, all right?
Yes.
So how do you know how to link them to forces? Because your whole system is already highly inhomogeneous.
So we don't know exactly. All we know is the force we apply, right? And what we then have to do is, first of all, we have to have a complete characterization of the tissue as a whole, which will be the next five slides. And then there's even more. And then we'd have to sort of add up the strains that you get relative to the forces that you apply, and then see whether that, at least in sum, totals out. Which, if you add up all of these sort of strains, you actually get the strain that you get in total for that whole set of tissue, which is somewhat reassuring, right?
So, Christopher, right. There are, I think there's work by Jan Charas and perhaps some other labs who have looked at stretching monolayers of cell culture cells and watching them divide. Is that a similar general message to stretching these in vitro epithelia?
I would not be surprised if it weren't. Was that too many negatives?
I think it might agree.
I think they might have the same problem.
So well, again, it's a question of whether that's a problem or a feature.
But
they can also do rhythmic stretching. So yep. I wonder whether that. So maybe we should have a look and see what they say. Yep. I would be surprised if it was the same cells each time.
I would be surprised. Yeah. Okay. Right. So. That being said, we'll have to go to overall elastic properties. And so now we're at the creepy solid again. And so this is a wing disk between two cover slips, and we're going to stretch it out. And then what's actually going to happen is that the attachment isn't perfect, so it releases here. And what you'll see is that it's being stretched out, it releases, springs back, and basically goes back to the original thing. Which sort of, at first, makes you think this is just a piece of rubber. Which, of course, it isn't. And by now, this sort of thing has enveloped everything, right? Has eaten it up completely. And so actually what you'll see, if you sort of want to come later, you'll see that there's sort of structures here, which are very, very elastic, and so they look like a solid that has some sort of viscous timescale associated with it, which is basically just the magnet still pulling it out, right? Which is basically that this thing is a live thing, which has myosin in it, which does all the work, and so this is actually an elastic thing, in that sense, right? And we'll get to this in just a minute. What you'll also see is that, again, this sort of retracts with a certain time scale. You can quantify this, so you can see the change in length as a function of time. This is basically when we're just linearly pulling on it. And so basically this linear pulling on it will basically here be a straight line, which gives us the Young's modulus. And then it releases here, and when it releases, we get a time scale of relaxation. But note that the starting point and the ending point are more or less in the same ballpark. Also, if you sort of look at force extension, so look at the force that you apply as a function of this, these different curves here are now from one wing disk. But the color code is such that the black one is the whole disk. The red one is just the wing pouch, so the thing that will become the wing. And the green stuff is the hinge notum region. Which sort of is the same thing as saying I have two springs in series, and I look at the elongation of the whole thing, and I have one spring and of the other spring. And then this is spring one, this is spring two, and these are both springs in series. And the spring constants, or the elastic moduli that you get for all of this, are basically the same. So it's more or less homogeneous in that sense. We cannot just look at the elongation, but also the constriction perpendicular to that. There's a the constriction perpendicular to that, which will give us the Poisson ratio. And there's some difference in the type of tissue that you can get, or the type of Poisson ratio, but most of the time it's round about 0.5. But actually, the whole disc and the wing notum region in particular are quite a bit higher. Now, that's not a problem for anyone who thinks that there's a theorem that says Poisson ratio cannot be higher than 0.5, because that theorem is for three-dimensional materials in three dimensions, and not three-dimensional materials in two dimensions, because we're looking at just two dimensions here. So you can easily get higher Poisson ratios. And so now we get to the thing that this is active. So what we did here, or what Thomas did here, is that he again has a wing disc here. He stretches it out. He relaxes it. He stretches it out. Does this four or five times for an hour. And it's all nicely elastic. And then he goes and hits it with a hammer, i.e. kills it with alcohol. And then it doesn't relax anymore. Right? So if you watch, if you try and see here, it actually goes in a bit, folds up somewhat, to see that that's actually the case, pulls it out again until it releases, and it actually releases back here, and it's still completely deformed. Right? So as soon as you kill it, it's plastic. So if I take a bit of this off the magnet and put it here, it'll just flow off.
Could it be that you're altering the passive properties by flowing in alcohol?
It could be. I'm not completely sure. I would know how. But, I mean, to sort of rule this out, we would just have to kill it in a couple of other ways. Yeah. So we've just killed it with one way. We just killed it one way. We're not that brutal.
So what is the concept of death that you are using?
Well, actually here, it's basically that. It just stays plastically. The form tells us that something has changed drastically. The concept of death is basically just that you know that if you flush these things with alcohol, they do die.
Yeah, but alcohol denatures proteins, so you've lost three-dimensional structure of proteins.
Okay, so we should kill them some other way. Good.
It's interesting, because I thought it would be the right way to kill them. It's definitely a good way to kill them. But as the tissue undergoes oxidative stress, it has a bunch of other reactions too.
You have a better idea, haven't you?
An actual hammer?
No. But you said that after 1 to 2 hours, the disc is dead. I mean, there's no self-perforation, so you would just wait a few hours and then try the experiment again.
You can do that. I mean, the thing, so there's dead and dead, right? So after 1 to 2 hours, they're not dead. They're just not proliferating anymore. They're still metabolizing. So that's not completely dead. It's just that they're not growing, right? That was what Suzanne was sort of telling in her talk, was that you can keep wing discs alive for a long time, you just can't get them to grow in culture for a long time. And so it's not that you have to sort of so the killing is not that simple. Right. So that was basically what I wanted to say about this. There's just one more thing about folds, but I'll skip this because I want to still go to the molecular sensors. Do you have the time? Yes?
So my question is,
understand when you say, or you kind of propose that differentiation would relax the stresses on the system? Is that... Because if you pull on it more, then they divide, and then it relaxes locally the stresses. Is that what you're suggesting?
Well, if you think of the amount of division or the amount of increased proliferation that we get for this, that does not actually change the stresses significantly.
So it has
so in that sense, well, the function that it has is, if you sort of think of the model and think that that's right, the function that it has is it controls the size. Because the initial growth factors, growth factor pattern, leads to differential growth, which leads to stresses, which leads to growth, which flattens out, which stops growing in the end. Right? And so this, the function of that in this framework would be size control.
So that's kind of an isotropic stress in that sense. If you add proliferation, then...
In terms of what we did experimentally, it's isotropic. In terms of what you see as it grows, it's not isotropic, right? So you have this...
So the fact that you like pull on it, and then it reversibly goes back. That means that even though if there's differentiation and you add more kind of round cells, they don't play like so much role in the relaxation of these stresses, right? Because you get exactly the same shape back.
Yeah, but I mean, that's you sort of have to look at this quantitatively. The number of cells that we add are maybe 20 cells to 20,000.
Yeah.
So you won't see that when you release it.
And I think this is also in line with what... was said here that if you put on this sheet of epithelial cells, you also don't see so much differentiation, but they only change their shapes, and the relaxation goes in.
I'm not completely sure what you mean by differentiation.
That's polymerization.
Okay.
Yeah.
But then again, it depends on the time scale. It depends on the amount, right?
Yeah.
You then have to start to think quantitatively,
yeah.
Right? Because if you pull on it, you see an increase in proliferation. And so you add 20 cells to your 20,000 cells, that will not change anything,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But whether you add 10 or 20 is a big change in proliferation rate. So you don't have to change the whole thing to have an influence of tension on proliferation rate. Mm-hmm. So, does that make sense?
Yeah.
Say something about how quick the response is to the stretching. If you have live imaging of proliferation, is there a lag? And then you start to see more proliferation, or what's the time?
So we're imaging about once every 10 minutes or so for this hour. So within that, I can't say anything about shorter than 10 minutes. And after 10 minutes, we don't see any sort of big difference between 10 minutes and later on. I mean, it's because the thing is, it's hard to say whether there's something that initially waits and then grows and then is constant, or that then the fact that the divisions start to disappear because it's not happy means that there's an initial peak. And so that's hard to actually say with any sort of confidence, I think.
Could you image every minute or every half a minute?
It depends on the microscope you're using. With the one that we were using, we were sort of bleaching it out otherwise, and we didn't want to image too much because of phototoxicity, so we just tried to keep it at a minimum. But probably with something more sophisticated, you could increase the timing. Right, so you have now all had time to read the conclusions of part one. So let me come to part two, which is molecular force sensing. And so this is Dominic Ewe's work. And the idea is basically simple. And we have actually heard the basic idea before from Denise Montel. So the idea is you have two cells. So this is a cell membrane. This is a cell membrane. and they are connecting via cell-cell junctions, which are cation molecules, and then that cation connects via alpha and beta catenin to actin to the cytoskeleton, and so if the cytoskeleton contracts, then this will be under tension. And so the idea is, in that bit here, so this is that bit, you add a molecular force sensor, a fret-based force sensor, where you have two fluorophores linked by some elastic linker. And then if this is under tension, then this is stretched out, so they are further apart. And if it's not under tension, it's less far apart. To be sure that you're doing not just some random thing, there's another way to do this. So rather than adding this to cation here, you add this at the very end, where it's actually, it should just be free floating here, so it shouldn't be under tension when there's tension within the cell. So that's the basic idea. There's two groups that have done this before. There's one, Jim Nelson's group, that has done it in mammalian cells and had E-cation in MVCK cells. And they have sort of stretched two cells and looked at the fret index here as a function of stretching and seen that something sort of decreases. And Denise Montel has looked at it in border cells in Drosophila, and they have, and she has seen that the front-to-back ratio of the fret index is different. So one thing that we're doing different is, well, first of all, we're in Drosophila, so we're in this regime. And the second thing that we're doing differently is that we're actually not adding E-cation with the force sensor to the genome, but we're taking out E-cation and replacing it with E-cation with the sensor. So we have it in the endogenous locus, and after some fiddling, we have it in homozygous thing. They're not fertile, but they're viable. So everything that makes junctions has a sensor in what I'm going to say.
You know how much force do you need to stretch the force sensor?
Hook up. Two or three more slides. No, sorry, four more slides. So, just for what happens, it's always good to sort of think of what actually happens when you want to do this. So the basic principle I said is you have these two fluorophores, you have an elastic linker, and then when you pull them further apart, what happens is that the donor molecule, which is the cyan fluorescent protein, cannot transmit its excitation to the acceptor molecule anymore. Because that drops drastically with distance, so there's, after a certain distance, there's a 1 over R to the 6 drop, which for aficionados is basically because these are two dipoles talking to each other, and a dipole with 1 over R to the 3 and another dipole with 1 over R to the 3 gives you a 1 over R to the 6. So this depends on a few things of these molecules, right? It depends on whether they have a spectral overlap. So whether the emission of the blue guy, which is this thing, overlaps with the absorption of the yellow guy. Right? And so anything here in that green shaded region will be able to transfer an excitation from one to the other. But these being sort of dipoles, the orientation will also be important. So depending on whether they're oriented that way or that way, you'll get a different amount of transfer. And so basically what you do, and how you determine this, is you want to excite the blue guy, and then if the blue guy can excite the yellow guy without exciting the yellow guy directly, you should get response from the yellow guy. Right? That's when you get fret. And if you excite the blue guy and you only get an answer of the blue guy, that's when you don't have fret. And so one thing that you notice here is if you excite CFP, you'll get this emission. If you excite YFP, you'll get this emission. So now you go measure with a microscope anything higher than, say, 550, which is basically where YFP emits. But actually, CFP also emits there. So you'll have to separate those. You'll have to be quite careful. And so the standard thing that people do when they do FRET is they do what's called ratiometric FRET. So you have your detection in the YFP channel, so anything higher than here. When you excite just CFP, and you have your detection in CFP, and then you have to subtract these and do the ratio and so forth, and then you get some FRET index. And that's what people usually do. And in most of what follows, we'll do this as well, because it's much, much easier experimentally. It's much, much more difficult data analysis-wise. So it depends on expression levels, it depends on sample thickness, it depends on the microscope you're using, it depends on your photomultiplier settings, it depends on your autofluorescence, it depends on your backgrounds. I could go on. Right? So you have to take care of much of this if you want to get any way reliable measurements. Another way to do it is to measure fluorescence lifetime. So what you do there is you excite your donor, you excite your CFP, and you measure how long it takes to get a reply from it, which basically means you measure how long a stake here lives. Now, if this thing can fret, there's another channel of relaxation, so it's shorter. And that will not depend on backgrounds and blah, 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 blah. It will basically depend on how well you can measure this lifetime. Now, these times are in the nanosecond range, so you need sub-nanosecond pulsed lasers that are intense enough, and you need the time resolution on a microscope, which is not what many people do. So that will be harder, but we'll do it in the end. And then basically what the measure will be is you'll measure the lifetime of just CFP, and you measure the lifetime of the FRET sensor. And take the ratio of those, and that will give you the FRET efficiency. And that will give you the real FRET efficiency without any sort of pitch factors. Now we get to the force. So what people have done that first created these force sensors is they have put them on optical tweezers, stretched them out, and looked at the FRET. And so what the FRET sensor that we're using, in the literature you'll find this. So they have FRET efficiency changes from 60 to 0, 60% to 0% on forces going from, say, 0 to 10 piconewtons. Actually, if you then look at the FRET efficiency as a function of force, you see that anything below about 8 piconewtons is 0, and above that you get something. Yes, of course.
So to get FRET efficiency go down to 0 when it's subtracted some direct excitation of the yellow line, how do you get to 0?
So that's the caveat that I wanted to bring up. If you look at the supplementary info of this paper, you actually find that they have not used that sensor, but they have used two different fluorophores for that particular experiment. Yeah, I didn't understand it either. And so the efficiency that you get there is has not actually anything to do with the efficiency of the FRET sensor that they were calibrating. But the spider silk thing has an elasticity that sort of has forces of 5-ish piconewtons. Right, so that's you have to read the small print. It's just Because if you look at the fluorescence at the photon counts, they actually do go to zero nicely, right? So you should act. So if it's a CFP YFP, you should not see this. So it's, yeah. Right. So anyway, we have put this threat sensor into flies in the endogenous locus, homozygotically, and look in the wing disk. So this is the wing disk. This is the YFP E-cation channel, and then we can get a threat index out of this by also having the CFP channel. So we're doing ratiometric, and this is what we get. We get something that varies somewhere between, yeah, whatever, 0.1 and 0.5 in terms of threat index, and you can't really make out the big pattern that you would sort of expect, right? You would expect to have this DV or AP, for instance, should sort of have something, maybe. But there's nothing obvious that you can see to the eyes. So not trusting your eyes, you average little boxes, one in the center, one somewhere dorsal ventral, one AP, one here, and one here. And you average those, and yeah, there's no big difference. There's no big difference, and if you look at the error bars, certainly also no significant difference between any of these patches. You can do another thing.
Should you normalize by the amount of Ikadiri, amount of connection that cells have to the others?
I'll show you not for these, but I can show you just per cell for each edge. Looked at what's happening, and you will see basically the same thing. Another thing that you can do for this whole global thing is look at the threat index as a function of cell size, or I shouldn't call it cell size, I should call it apical area and square microns. And again, so yeah, as you go out and have bigger cells, you see, well, if you want to be very, very, very optimistic, you see that this line is actually sloped slightly upwards, right? But not really.
Are you going to tell us a little more about properly calibrated?
Yeah, I will.
Sensors?
Yeah. If you see this, you of course go to the control sensor. Right? The control sensor should see nothing, which is basically the exact same thing. Right. So you can take everything of this together and have the force sensing sensor and the non-force sensing sensor. And I did it the other way around. This is the control, this is the actual sensor. Average it for the whole disk, and you basically see no difference. So you want to be a bit more specific, and you want to be a bit more thorough, and you want to be a bit more to the point, and you want to look at actual force measurements. So you want to actually do forces and see whether something is there. Because there could just be no force difference or no forces in the wing disk, right? Could be. Even though I've just spent an hour telling you that there are. So there's a couple of things that one can do. You can disrupt actinomycin. So then there should be no forces anymore. You can activate myosin. So there should be much more forces. You can have forces that are there by overproliferation by putting in clones. Or you can actually do forces and stretch these things as we did before. And so we'll sort of do that and see what we get. So if you depolymerize actin, you can look at what we do here. We put latrinkline B into wing disks, and this is actin, this is myosin, and what you see is that on the time scale of about 8 minutes is what these movies are, there's basically nothing there anymore in terms of actin network, and the myosin just sort of clumps together. So there should be sort of no more tensions there. So you look at threat index of these things before, after 5 minutes, after a quarter of an hour. Right, so you see that the threat index decreases slightly. You see the threat index also decreases slightly more for the control construct. So the light blue is the control construct, the dark blue is the sensor. Now, if these things are under tension and you release tension, what happens, or what should happen, is that they actually go back together, so you should actually see an increase in threat efficiency. Now, of course, you can be positive and see, well, the threat sensor has a less sharp decrease than the threat, than the control construct, right? But I'm not too convinced by that. So you can go ahead and increase myosin activity. So you do ionomycin treatment and activate myosin. So you see that this goes into the whole disk, and you also see that the myosin activity here is actually strongly increased, and there's really strong pulling on this, right? Again, dark blue is the sensor, light blue is the control. You get the picture.
This horse is being
beaten
today.
No. I'm not done. No,
it's not done yet.
You can actually pull on these things, right? So, I mean, this is sort of the ultimate thing, right? I mean, you force it, and you want to see a force response, right? And, right, I mean, these things decrease, right? Which is actually what you get if you force, and you put on tension, and you get a decrease in threat index. Until you also do the control construct, which actually sees the same thing. Right, now we're starting to think which is stupid, which is can't measure threat, right? So we got a threat construct, some other threat construct, that is ATP sensitive. And that has a conformation change when you add ATP, and if you do this in the salivary glands of Drosophila, you see a strong decrease in threat. And there's also a control construct that doesn't do this, and then that's constant. And there's about a twofold change in threat index, right? Which is, so that's...
What happens? Or what is this, a new sensor?
This is a new sensor that doesn't measure force, but that just has a threat response in Drosophila. Because we're now thinking...
Threat response to what?
To ATP.
Okay.
Because we're now thinking we're stupid, and we're just absolutely incapable and cannot do anything that is related to threat. So we want to convince ourselves, and hopefully you, that we still do. So one of the things is, right, all of the things that we see here are at most 10% changes. This is about a factor of two. And so, yes, we have threat. If we don't do anything or have the control, that doesn't change. If we add ATP, it changes. And the control that should always be in the conformational state, that always has the same thing. And so we can actually measure threat. But to finish it off, I said that brachymetric threat is just a nightmare, and you have to be very, very careful. And it might just be that these things are just... So if you do brachymetric threat, you have lots of systematic errors. And so you have to be very, very careful about doing those right. And all the signals that we've seen were very, very small. And so it could just be that we're swamped. There's something there, but we're swamped by our systematic errors. So we'll do the right thing. Do the proper thing, look at lifetime measurements, and see what actual signals we get. So this is sort of what you see in textbooks. You have your laser that has sort of a sub-nanosecond lifetime that excites your fluorophore, and then as a function of time, you look at the response. And there's a couple of nanoseconds lifetime, typically, and that's an exponential process. So on a single logarithmic scale, you get a straight line, and slope of that straight line is your rate, or your inverse time. Now, of course, also lifetime measurements are not that simple. There's also a background there that you have to take into account, because that thing will sort of go to this and not to zero. Actually, zero here is at minus infinity on a logarithmic scale, so, right. And there might be some other fluorescent process, like autofluorescence, that has a short lifetime here on top, but you can still sort of see a pretty straight line here that gives you the lifetime. Right, so that you can. So let's look at the sensor. There it is. Now, I have to see that I get this right. What it says here, the red one is just the CFP. The dark blue one is the control construct, and the green one is the sensor. Right. So you see that there's the activation, and there's a decrease. There's some sort of background, and there's a short time scale here, and then here you can sort of get out the time scale. So let's blow this bit here up, where you can reasonably well determine the time scales. And that's what it looks like. So this is CFP. The blue is the control construct, and the green is the sensor. You have pretty good accuracy on what you're doing here, right? So you can actually see that the green, because this is just one decade. So the green here is actually before the blue. Here it's actually behind the blue. So the green is actually slightly slower, ever so slower than the blue. And the red is even slightly more slower. So there is an increase in thread efficiency for the sensor.
Sorry,
relative to the CFP.
This is from the disk.
This is from the disk, yes. Yes. But the control construct has the same sort of thread. And it's really, really low. Right. So if you want to change this, you will not be able to do that. Or you maybe will. So just one more thing. See. We can then do, for instance, no, that was not what I wanted to show. We can do this same latrinculin B treatment, which just kills off the actin. And then look at the lifetimes that we see before and after. And so it actually lives slightly longer, which means that there's slightly less thread, which again is not what you should see. And again, if you do the control measurement, that's the same. And so I guess I'll just summarize this by a statement of Confucius. The hardest thing of all is to find a black cat in a dark room, especially if there's no cat. And that was what I wanted to say, except thank all the people who actually did the work. So the whole second part was Dominic Gehler's work, and for that we're collaborating with Connie Bosler. And then in the first thing there was Tinry's model. Thomas Schluck and Flavio Lanfranconi did the elastic measurements, and Ulrike Nienhaus the in the image. Thank you.
Well, that was great, telling me the foot sensor didn't work. Are you actually saying that the force is in the wrong range, or the threat sensor doesn't work? Where are we pointing the finger here?
Well, if you plot this to scale, right, the threat sensor, the cationins, the alpha cationins, and the actin, which is basically this. I don't know how to put this in here without completely messing it up. So the nice thing of when you do single molecule and you do which gives a nice threat force sensor, I'm not sure that you can actually do this here.
But wait, these aren't barrels. These aren't the beta barrels of the YFP. You just put the linear sequence, or what are you representing with the yellow YFP?
That should be roughly the...
That's the dimensions of the beta barrel of YFP.
You get the whole thing sort of twisted around and...
Yeah, and then if you have, right, your threat signal is also orientation dependent. Yeah. And so you get changes that way all the time. And so that's the signal you'll see. And that signal you'll see whether it's here or here.
I thought there was a coherent fusion.
It's in the, so you have to put this in here.
Yeah.
So I mean it is part of this.
So I guess the question is also, so probably you need to fit it in between...
You somehow
it's
need...
Not, it's not obvious to me that you actually want to measure tension carried by cationin as opposed to actin, etc., etc.
Yeah,
so
I mean that's...
But even so, you presumably want to put it in between the domain that actually binds
right.
to alpha cationin.
Right, so you put it in here, you put it in, that, in this domain here.
And but I guess I still didn't quite understand. So, has anybody actually demonstrated that the sensor works? You know, you somehow said that a graph of paper kind of
fade
and switch.
Yes. Let's see.
Yeah, it could be something about the microenvironment in the cortex of the disk that just means that's never going to work. Or is something fundamentally wrong with this coherent molecule?
Well, I can show you the border cell migration things that we did because we thought we were stupid. So these are border cells in the Drosophila embryo. And I'm not completely sure now which sensor this actually corresponds to. It could be the one that's ours that's endogenous, or the one that's just in addition. Could be both. I don't remember. We did both, and I don't know. I don't remember which this image is from. Right. And so then these are the intensity pictures of YFP, and then you try to be as careful as possible with your threat index calculation, and you get images like that. And then you have to define a front and back ratio, which no one really tells you how. But you can do this in several ways. And depending on how you do this, you can either get a lower threat in the signal relative to control, the same, or the other way around. So it's not something that's specific to the wing disk. And we've actually, there's another thing, we've also looked at dorsal closure. So dorsal closure has this sort of nice force things that pull cells together, pull a tissue together. And then you can look at these oscillating cells and look at before and after. And actually very nicely identify the cell shapes and the borders. And then you can sort of look at perpendicular to one of these contractions, or in the region of these contractions, what the difference is. And so that's the area oscillations. And then the signal is control signal, same thing. if you look at cell elongations, again, same thing. And this is now with the endogenous locus sensor.
So a bunch of questions. We'll start with students first.
So in the E-cadherin sensor, why don't you have it in the holophilic region? Because I'm assuming the stretch should be more there, right? And where the two E-cadherins are interacting. I mean, is how do you decide where you put these?
So deciding where to put this, we've actually just followed the people who've done it before. But you can sort of think of that here, there should be, the reasoning makes sense, that here there should be a bigger force signal that you can see, because these things are basically just nicely interlatched things that do not move. Right? And so here, the actin is the thing that makes the force, and then that would make the force on the sensor. That's the idea.
Okay.
So is there maybe a problem in the time resolution at which we are analyzing effect stretching? Because all these cells that have this very dynamic actin and myosin networks to contribute, they are pulsatile, so these pulses are of the order of minutes. So maybe these things are stretched and unstretched of the order of a minute, and this is maybe the time scale at which it should be looked at.
Right. So, two things to that. One is in dorsal closure, we have done that. Two is the wing disc cells actually don't oscillate.
So, you said that it also depends a lot on the orientation of these two dipoles, right? And in the worst case, if they're orthogonal, then there's no overlap, right? Mm-hmm. Is there a way that one can try to realign them, with the polarized laser or something? Kind of, that you always have the same orientation?
I'm not completely sure how you would do that. But, I mean, it might be worth thinking about. But yeah, I'm not sure how you would do that.
Yeah, maybe there's a way to, when you first made the recombinant version of this protein, check what the dipole of your two. Because as soon as you put it in the cortex.
As soon as you put it in the cortex, it'll change.
Mike.
Yeah, I mean, we played a little also film on these three things. And actually, the wire field is a piece. The model of the frame is with the double exponential, with three factors which are very similar. So I'm surprised that you are just taking a single exponential approach.
Oh, that's what I did for the purposes of illustration and simplicity. What you actually do, let me see. What you actually do with this is you actually fit something that has a background and a double exponential in here. And then you look at the different time scales and you find that there's basically one that comes from autofluorescence, mm-hmm. and the other one is the thing that you're then looking at.
Also, your offset is very big. Normally, the traces of the strings are not super.
That depends on how you do it. But, yeah.
Is there a possibility that your construction is not working and if you try to test the flies by the means?
Yes. No, not the flies, but her construct, yes. I mean, okay. As I said.
The construct already in the fly that is
working. Yeah. I mean, not in the actual fly that she looked at.
No, okay.
Right.
Yeah, but the stocks in the stocks
are. But the stocks are the same. Yeah. And as I said, the thing that I showed is we did it for both, and I'm not sure which of the two the picture is from. But we did it for both, and it looks the same in both. Yeah.
Could I go back to the first half of your talk?
Yeah.
So I'm a bit stuck on this one-hour time window. So what you're seeing is this sort of increase in cells entering mitosis when you apply stretch. So they must be sort of waiting around in G2. So Is there any way of asking whether you have an overall effect on the cell cycle? Is this just you've got a transient effect which will then result, which actually won't lead to a long, you know, persistent effect on the cell cycle?
To do that, you would have to do that on longer timescales. And so basically what, knowing what I've learned 2 weeks ago, that there are people who can culture these things for 14 hours, the obvious thing is to ask them how and do it for 10 hours.
Okay. Last question on the fact again. I mean, this spread measure forces which are orthogonal to the junction, right? Not parallel to the junction.
That's the cartoon, yes.
But would you also imagine that this is the case? I mean, that preferentially you would measure forces between two cells that are pulling one against, one away from the other, not shearing.
Right, but the thing is, I mean, so what you can do is if you look at something like this and you have a cell that's pulled out like that, you would think that, right, the sensor here should be more active than the sensor there. Right, because this thing is on the tension this way, and so if the sensor acts in that direction or in that direction, then this should not see anything and this should. Right. So that way you can sort of look at this. But
that's quite an assumption to me. I mean, you're assuming where the tensions are experienced. If we looked at a Juba localization, for example, it's very punctate, which we sort of inferred, well, most of the tension has been experienced in a spot. And one of the worries that I've had with these FRET sensors is you're looking for the absence of the signal. You look at the size of these Ajuba puncta, they're basically like diffraction spots. And if your spot where the tension is experienced is small enough, it'll be invisible unless you have some super resolution microscopy to do your FRET, right? I mean, it depends how big that spot is where you're losing the signal. In other words, how big is the spot where it could be stretched? Could be just too small to see.
I mean, one of the major differences between the two systems, here you have an epithelium. In the other case, you have a cluster of cells that wants to move in an extracellular matrix. So it could be that it doesn't work in an epithelium.
I've just shown you the border cell migration data. Haven't I?
Yeah, but this is exactly the case. You have a cluster of cells.
Yeah.
It moves within an extracellular matrix, right? And you're measuring forces between the extracellular matrix and the cluster of cells.
But the border cells don't show anything either.
So the amniocerosa doesn't show anything.
And the amniocerosa doesn't show anything either. Yeah.
So we want to imagine laborious and pleasant way of trying to estimate the background. Reach CFP and wipe you down, and then they stimulate in whatever blue, and you look at the signal in red after you reach, etc. Make up a little model with some number of parameters, and fit. And then presumably you can do it for a FRET sensor that has this nice. Ratio of almost 2 that you showed, and for this one, did you would it reveal that the signal to noise in this?
That's why we did the
much lower than another.
That's why we did the lifetime measurements in the end.
Oh, so right? Lifetime. Okay.
And so the lifetime shows the same thing, right? So that's that's why we went for lifetime in the end.
We're trying to find a hole in the net, but we haven't found it yet. Any other questions? Can I ask a final question? Are you aware, or have you maybe have a look at, are there any other FRET-based force sensors that are out there in the literature, which from the don't have any hidden supplementary materials or anything, where you would now be going to try and measure forces in tissue?
I'm not completely sure from all that I've seen. So I mean there's the same sort of thing in Winklin things, but the basic construct is the same. I mean, there's one other thing that's in the literature, which is one that sort of has a bit of peptide that undergoes a conformational change depending on force, so that should have a slightly higher forces that it's sensitive to. And then, of course, it also has different fluorophores. But I haven't actually looked closely enough at all the small print yet to be sure that that's a way to go.
And the integrin one from Alex Dunn.
What about that? I have to look it up. I don't know.